Good morning. Thank you all for coming out today as we tackle a difficult subject. We're going to be talking today about sexual behavior and substance use, and it's somewhat uncomfortable. We don't want to talk about it, but we have to talk about it, and we feel it's important to talk about it in the context that we know, you all know, what God's plan was for us. God gave us sex as a gift to humanity. And sin has, you know, kind of warped, well, that's true, it is, it's a gift from God. Sin has warped that and caused, as in everything that God's gift, caused things to be warped and twisted. And so we want to be wise, and we need to have information. And so today we're going to be talking about a difficult subject. We're going to be talking about sex. We're going to be talking about sex that takes place outside of marriage, outside of God's plans. And as we talk about that, we want to be very clear that Andrews University is committed to upholding the standards of the Seventh-day Adventist Church and the values that reflect a wholesome lifestyle. We believe that God's plan is best for us. We believe that the instructions that God gave us is best. And sexual misconduct, sexual assault, harassment, rape is just a manifestation of when we don't follow God's plan. But we want to be clear that we're following God's plan and what our Seventh-day Adventist values are. So we believe in refraining from the use of alcohol and tobacco and drugs and other substances that hurt our bodies. We're a tobacco-free campus, just to state that very clearly. And we also ask our students to refrain from the use of these substances both on and off campus. So our students that come here and apply filled out an agreement to abide by a code of conduct, and that includes to refrain from the use of illegal substances both on and off campus. We also believe that sexual activity, as is God's plan, should take place in the context of a marriage between a man and a woman. So we're putting this up front to say, yes, we're going to be talking about things that are outside of God's plan, but we believe very firmly in what God designed for us. So just so you know, not only do we have our Seventh-day Adventist Christian Jesus-inspired plan, and we're going to uphold those here at the university, we also have some government laws that we have to uphold. Title IX, which is a comprehensive federal law that prohibits the discrimination on the basis of sex in any federally funded plan. You may have heard of Title IX as it relates to sports, that if the school had a men's sports team, they had to be a women's sports team. Right now, Title IX is focused on sexual assault, making sure that women have equal opportunity to education. There's also the new Violence Against Women Act. That's another comprehensive legislative set of laws that tells colleges and universities how to make sure that women are protected on campuses.
Of course, you might be asking yourself, why do we need to talk about this, especially at the seminary? Well, on the one hand, you are students, and we are obligated to let you know what our expectations of students are on this campus. On the other hand, you're pastors in training, and it seems reasonable that we share a conviction here around the topic of sexual integrity. Yet in some respects, and in many respects, there are risk factors within ministry itself that make pastors more prone than the average student to sexual misconduct. And so we want to look at some of those risks right off the bat here. First of all, ministry gives you a position of power and religious authority. And that authority and that power can be abused, and you need to be aware of that. Second, your sense of calling can be a channel of blessing to other people, but can also lead to a creeping sense of entitlement and exceptionalism, placing us sometimes in our minds above the law, or we might think it ought to give us special treatment. We also work with vulnerable populations in ministry, children and youth, bereaved persons, divorced people, sexually abused, and oftentimes in our role in working with these people, we will develop relationships of trust. They will open up the broken places of their lives to us. And that is a sacred trust that we have as pastors. But it can also, it also means that we have to uphold some strict professional boundaries, or we can find ourselves in a place where things become confused and we may violate someone else's rights. And finally, all of us should be aware of the proximity of our sexuality to our spirituality. And as pastors, we are down into this area of talking about people's spiritual lives. That opens up very personal places. And we need to be aware that our desire to connect with God sometimes can become blurred with our desire to connect with another human being. And years ago, Dr. Staples, proper English gentleman that he is, took my seminary cohort aside and explained the birds and the bees in pastoral language to us and said, you just need to be aware of this close relationship and how easy it is to go across the boundary from spiritual discourse into sexual activity. So over the last several years, sadly, we have had SDA Theological Seminary students found responsible for a number of things. And it is my responsibility to work with students when they do make poor judgment, errors in judgment. So we've had indecent exposure, we've seen domestic violence, public intoxication, non-consensual sex or rape, premarital sex, adultery, sexual harassment of various forms, and threats to harm others. So at the outset, we just want you to know that we are all human beings and we are vulnerable. We're creatures of the flesh, and we begin today with an acknowledgement that there are real risks to all of us, and we need to be aware what they are. Actually, learning about sexual misconduct now in your seminary training may help reduce the risk of it reoccurring or being overlooked later in your professional life. The actual estimated number of clergy sexual abuse cases is not well documented, but it may be as high as 15% of clergy who have engaged in some form of clergy sexual misconduct. A large national study found that just a little over 3% of women who attend religious services once a month or more have been victims of clergy sexual abuse as adults. In other words, if you took your average congregation of 400 adult members, 7 women in that congregation, on average, would have been victimized at some point in their adult lives by a member of the clergy. And today we're going to present to you, just to bring this a little closer to home, we've constructed 3 sample cases. Now the names have been redacted, the details have been altered so that none of these cases match an actual case, but I can assure you that these scenarios are very real in every other way. So let's begin with fact pattern number 1. This is Kyle. Kyle is married, he has no children, and he's accepted a ministry role on campus. He gave Bible studies to a female undergraduate who was seeking them, and he started to ask questions about her personal life along the way, and then began making remarks like, why doesn't a beautiful girl like you have a boyfriend? In addition, Kyle offered to give her a ride home more than once, but she declined. And then, one day, after a particularly long Bible study, he hugged her goodbye and then proceeded to grope her. Confused, she later told a friend who encouraged her to report the incident to the Student Life Office. Now, Kyle abused his position of religious authority, and he was found responsible for sexual harassment and non-consensual sexual contact. He was suspended by the university, and his case was passed on to the Seminary Student Conduct Committee here in this building, where a decision was made as to whether or not he would ever be eligible to return to the seminary program.
We have another case, Kate. She's also married but has children. Her husband was a seminary student and was verbally abusive to her. They'd gone to counseling, but things weren't going well. And so she worked on campus to make ends meet, and one of her coworkers was a married male seminary student. While her husband was on a study tour, her co-worker began to pay more attention to her, and they began having conversations, and she confided in him about her marital troubles, and he showed her sympathy by listening and giving her hugs, And they became increasingly intimate, engaging in what we're calling outer course, so not intercourse, but other sexual activity.
Becoming aroused with your clothes fully on.
She stayed dressed, okay? She stayed dressed. So she began to feel guilty, convinced that she had committed adultery, and tried to break off the relationship. He contended that they'd done nothing wrong, nothing happened, and persisted in contacting her in an unwelcome and unwanted way. Eventually, she contacted the Office of Student Life. So Kate's coworker was found responsible for consensual sexual contact outside of marriage, or in other words, adultery. The seminary student's conduct committee identified that he should be counseled and that she should also be counseled. The seminary conduct felt that he had broken the code of professional conduct here at the seminary, and he was deemed not fit to be a candidate for ministry and was indefinitely suspended from the seminary.
Our last case is Carl. Carl is a married international student. He experienced his call to ministry later in life. He had one child with his current wife and another from a previous marriage. His wife confided in a friend that shortly after they were married, he became very controlling. He was upset upon moving here by her adoption of American attitudes and dress. They also disagreed how to raise the older child. When she resisted, he would tell her to touch not the Lord's anointed.
It's not a joke.
We wish we were making this up.
These are exact words. This is not a joke.
Tensions mounted until one evening, the wife called the police. The police found that he had put his fist through a wall and told her that he was angry enough to kill her. The police lodged him in the county jail for the night, as they must do. Campus safety was called our office, and the wife was offered temporary housing in an undisclosed location. Now, Carl was found responsible for domestic abuse, destruction of university property, we had to repair that wall, and making threats to harm another person. He was mandated to undergo a threat assessment upon his release from jail. His wife chose not to move to a safe location, and the police returned Carl to his home the next day. Although the university suspended Carl for the remainder of the semester, and the conduct committee placed his seminary status on hold until further review, his wife staunchly defended his call and continued to minimize the incident. Unfortunately, domestic abuse is one of the most difficult things that we handle in office, mainly for this reason, and we'll speak in just a moment about the complexities of domestic abuse.
So you are probably aware that there's quite a bit of talk in the media about sexual assault on college campuses. There's a movie that's going to be coming out, a documentary about the hunting ground, which refers to people that, young men most particularly, that are actually hunting or looking for vulnerable women that they can take sexual advantage of sexually. There have been magazine covers talking about rape on college campuses. So there's quite a bit going out in the media about sexual assault. Rolling Stone magazine did a big set of articles last fall that there was a lot of controversy about. And then the New Yorker magazine shows a cover of a young lady who was sexually assaulted, raped on her college campus, and in protest, she carried around her mattress that she alleges she was raped on for the entire school year. And in fact, she carried it across the stage at her graduation at Columbia this past May to protest and to bring awareness of sexual assault on college campuses. So there's a lot of pressure on colleges to make sure that we do what we can to prevent and to deal with sexual assault, and it's quite often in the media. Right now, the statistics show that 1 in 5 college women report being sexually assaulted. I'm sorry, 1 in 5 are sexually assaulted, but only 12% make official reports. 9 out of 10 of those know their attacker, and 9 out of 10 sexual assaults are committed by serial rapists. So when we talk about rape on college campuses or in the environment that we have here, we're not talking about a creepy guy that's behind a bush, total stranger rape that's reaching out and grabbing someone and throwing them to the ground. We're talking about, in almost every case, some sort of acquaintance rape or misconduct. And then normally there's only a small percentage of people that engage in this activity, but they do it repeatedly over and over again.
Okay, we'd like to tap into some of your beliefs and attitudes around sexual assault. And so we are going to ask you to log in, if you have a wireless device, to live.voxvote.com. The PIN number is here. As soon as you get to livevoxvote.com, they're going to ask you to put in that PIN number, 29359.
Yeah, so go ahead, 29359, and then we're actually going to be able to see how your perceptions are. You're going to be able to vote live, and we're going to put up on the screen what your thoughts and beliefs are right now. The first question we're going to put up.
Okay, and you can see the PIN number here, 29350. I'm sorry.
Next slide, sorry. Oh, do you have to switch to?
I'm in presenter view.
No, we're in presenter view, so we have to escape out of that probably. Okay. 29359. 29359. So when you get there, you put in 29359. So you're going to have to escape out of that probably.
You have to take it down.
Yeah.
No.
Can you alt tab?
I can't. All right, so you have a smooth plan until it doesn't go smoothly. Okay. All right, we're going to do this.
We'll figure out a way to get you to see it. Are you able to get to the live vote? Okay. All
okay,
right.
So that's great.
So we'll just pull up our first question so you can see. When a woman dresses provocatively, she is asking for trouble. So go ahead and vote. When a woman dresses provocatively, she's asking for trouble. What are your opinions? Do you strongly agree? Agree? Are you neutral? Do you disagree or strongly disagree? So we're actually seeing here on our screen, which unfortunately we can't get up on the monitor here, what you believe. So please go ahead and vote what your thoughts are. Not getting a signal or it's not working?
Okay, we've got 73 of you voted so far.
Okay, 73 of you have voted.
All right.
We need to get that up somehow.
And we're going to close it here in just a second. Okay, and there we brought it to a close. Okay, 38% of you strongly disagree with that.
38% of you strongly disagree.
20% of you disagree. And we have 23, about 30% of you who either agree or strongly agree that someone is asking
for trouble. Wow. So in this, just to be clear, we want to be clear that a woman is never responsible for rape. Never. No matter how you dress, no matter how you dress, no matter how I dress, well, no matter how a woman dresses, rape is no excuse. Sexual misconduct is no excuse. If I choose or am somehow persuaded that I want to walk stark naked across campus, it would be ugly, but it would not be my fault if I were raped. Do you understand? I want to be clear about that. I am never at fault for rape, no matter how I dress. We're going to go on to number two. A lot of women lead a man on and then cry rape. So what? Do you agree that a woman can lead a man on and then call rape? So go ahead and vote, please. Do you agree or disagree or somewhere in the middle?
Okay, the question's up in front of you.
So far, 42 people have voted.
Okay, we'll give you just a few more
seconds. Give you a few
more
minutes. So a lot of women can lead a man on. Can a woman lead a man on and then cry rape? So far, we've got 42 votes. Can we do it again? Can we refresh?
And I've stopped it. 142 of you.
142 of you voted.
Again, some very mixed results here. 18% strongly disagree with that. Another 30% disagree. And again, we have about 30% of you who agree or strongly agree that a lot of women lead a man on and then cry rape.
Wow. I guess I'll repeat again. I'll repeat again, there is never a reason for rape. Never. A woman does not lead you on and cause you to cry rape. There's never an excuse.
There is a view.
There is a view.
There is a view that for a man there is this point of no return. Actually, physiologically, you can always stop, gentlemen. And it's important to know that even if someone begins with consent, they can always withdraw that at any point in the process of two people being together.
What the question asks is not what you're stating afterwards.
Okay, so the question says, a lot of women lead a man on and then cry rape, correct? So, and I'm sorry you can't see the graph that we're looking at here. So right now, about 50% disagree with that statement, correct? Is that making sense?
She's simply saying it's demonstrative.
Correct.
Right.
I know there's no excuse for rape, but that's not what the question is asking. That's not how we are understanding
it. How you understand
the
question? The question doesn't say the word rape?
What the question sounds like is that the woman will lead on the man, and then you know something happens, and then she will cry out rape. So that's kind of, it's not very clear if this is actual, she said okay. No. She's just making it up. Like now.
All right, we'll accept that.
Well, okay, we'll accept that. Okay, we're good.
Here.
Wait. Well, because our question was not clear, or there's a perception that our question is not clear, we're just going to move on, and we're not going to talk about
I just want to briefly say that we should be very careful how we use the word never.
I did not.
Because if you use the word never, that is a problem.
Okay, you know what we're going to do? We're not going to debate the use of never right now. And so what? I can't even begin to go right now. Never is the word that I'm going to stick with, and you and I can meet afterwards and talk about it, but the use of never is going to not, we're going to stick with the use of the word never. I'm going to stick with the word never and rape in the same sentence forever. Okay? Never and rape are going to stay together in the same sentence. So we'll own the fact that our question was not clear. We'll own that. But the never and the rape will stay together at the same time. So we're going to move on because there's a lot of stuff we want to cover, and some of it hopefully is not as controversial. Okay, number three, what percent of reports to the police about sexual assault are false? So this will help maybe clarify. What percent of reports to the police, so these are people that report a sexual assault, are false? So this will kind of go along to that second question. What percent do you believe are false reports to the police? Okay. So we have the options of 2, 17%, 29, 44, and 50%. Okay, so right now we've got 79 of you voted.
All right, closing it down. Thank you for your votes. Okay, 52% of you say that 2% are false, and Debbie, is that right?
That's correct. Only 2% of reports for sexual assault to the police are considered false reports. Only 2%. So we are going to move on from this interesting topic, and actually go through some definitions, and then we're going to continue on with our presentation here. We're going to talk about what the definitions of sexual misconduct and consent and incapacitation. So right now, Andrews University has a sexual misconduct statement that says we're committed to maintaining a respectful learning environment that's free from sexual misconduct. Sexual misconduct in any form is prohibited and will not be tolerated.
Okay, sexual misconduct includes sexual penetration or sexual contact that occurs without effective consent of all individuals involved, and we will speak about consent in a moment.
Sexual misconduct also includes sexual exploitation, which is something we're seeing more of lately, and that's taking advantage of another person without their effective consent again. Examples include recording or transmitting a sexual act. And this happens, I'll just take a little note here, when people may be at a party or some sort of get-together, someone becomes drunk, and people start taking naked pictures of someone and then transmitting it. That is sexual exploitation and a violation of our sexual misconduct policy. Voyeurism or not informing a sexual partner of an STD is also sexual exploitation.
Sexual harassment can take one of two forms. It is also misconduct. Quid pro quo harassment involves an exchange of sexual favors for some benefit and often occurs when there's a differential of power, such as in the parishioner and pastor relationship. Hostile environment harassment includes conduct so severe and or pervasive that it unreasonably interferes with or limits one's ability to participate in or benefit from a particular setting, be that an academic setting, a work setting, etc. Or it creates a hostile, intimidating, or offensive environment. In fact, we had male seminary students approach our office just a couple of years ago asking for help and for training because of the stories that they had heard from their own female counterparts here at the seminary about a chilly climate for women. And while not everything they described could be categorized as sexual harassment, it was the kind of atmosphere that can breed opportunities for sexual harassment. Microaggressions, for instance, things that you just may say that are even slightly demeaning to women, can set up an environment where it is easy then to move into sexual harassment. Examples of harassment include unwelcome sexual advances, propositions or requests for sexual favors, unwelcome or inappropriate touching or physical contact, showing or displaying sexually suggestive, demeaning or objectifying objects, pictures or words, and also unwelcome or inappropriate comments, questions, or sexually suggestive jokes. Not long ago, Debbie and I were in a setting where a pastoral colleague was commenting to us that he felt that women needed to understand, if they're going to be in pastoral ministry, that there are times when male pastors just need to get together as guys and blow off a little steam.
Boys need to be boys.
And that women might not always like that, but that's the way it is in ministry. So we need to be careful because we are moving into a time where men and women will be sharing the, Seventh-day Adventist pastoral ministry together. This has been a kind of an all-guys club, no girls allowed, and we're moving into a different era, and we're going to have to check our male privilege, guys, on this score.
Sexual misconduct also includes stalking, engaging in a course of conduct toward a specific person that would cause a reasonable person to fear for his or her safety or suffer substantial emotional distress. I talk with the undergraduate students around the difference between being persistent and really liking someone and moving along a continuum from persistence to creepiness to stalking. So, I talk to our younger young men saying, be aware that you can be persistent when you like someone, but you can move along and then eventually cross that line into stalking. So some examples of stalking include unwelcome communication, always texting, always sending messages, following them, showing up outside their classes. It happens. Surveilling them, trespassing, unwelcome gifts, etc.
Because the Violence Against Women Act is also something that we are held accountable to, relationship violence has been highlighted on our campus as well. It's a pattern of unwelcomed or abusive or coercive behaviors used to exert power and control over a current or former partner. And these behaviors often create or increase in severity as time goes on, and they may become cyclical. Here's a little diagram that really shows us that at the heart of relationship violence is not violence, but power and control issues, which then manifest themselves in a variety of ways that can lead ultimately to physical or sexual abuse. And so this wheel of behaviors includes things like emotional abuse, putting her down or calling her names or making her think she's crazy, using isolation, controlling what she does, who she sees, where she goes, and most notably in our religious environment here, asserting male privilege, the man making all the big decisions, or being the one to define the roles of husband and wife in the home. Perhaps the most insidious part of relationship violence, however, is the cyclical nature of it. People move from love, affection, and attraction to arguing, insults, and then accusations, which then erupts at some point in a violent episode of some sort, followed by an apology, promises, and most often denial. And this is only to be repeated over and over and over again, drawing us in, erupting, and then drawing us back through again. This pattern can manifest itself both in dating relationships as well as in marriage relationships and other forms of intimate partnerships. And the important point, again, is that relationship violence can manifest in physically violent ways as well as in emotionally and psychologically damaging ways. Finally, I might add that if you're concerned that this is something that could happen to you, learning to develop and maintain a mutually respectful relationship within your marriage or within your dating life is very important and will keep you away from this cycle of violence. Sometimes one partner, however, has to respect themselves enough and their children enough to step away from an abusive relationship and refuse to live any longer with an abusive partner. That may be the only solution.
We're going to talk a little bit right now about two key terms or two key issues as it relates to sexual misconduct: consent and incapacitation. So to just start it off a little lightheartedly, we're going to explain a little bit about what consent is.
All right, we'll need the sound for this.
No sound, we need sound.
Let's try again. Give me the thumbs up there, gentlemen. I love it when tech people scramble. All right. Okay, there we go.
Hi, I'm here and I'm trying to figure out what consent really is and how to get it right. Hey, can I borrow your phone?
No.
Foiled. Hey, can I have your phone?
No.
Hey, give me your phone. Victory. Was that consent?
No, that was coercion. Consent must be voluntary.
Jonathan?
Yeah?
Hey, can I borrow your phone really fast?
Okay,
great. How about now?
No, clearly he was incapacitated and could not give consent.
Hey, can I borrow your phone? He didn't say no. Did I get it right?
No. Two negatives do not make a positive. The absence of no does not mean yes.
Hey, can I borrow your guys' phones?
Yeah, sure.
Why? What do you want it for?
It's okay. Don't worry about it. I'm sure it's fine. Just give it to her.
Tell me I'm good.
Group phones make things complicated. Looks like the middle person was intimidated. Sorry, no go.
Oh. Look, can I just have your phone?
Yeah. Just no texts or international calls.
Are you comfortable with me changing your ringtone?
As long as it's not disco.
Can I play with your game center?
No, my games are sacred to me, but you can update my software.
Shazam?
Shazam.
Oh. Tell me, please.
A conscious, voluntary decision without coercion or intimidation with clearly spoken boundaries. Congratulations.
Yes.
As we talk about consent, I'm going to just take an opportunity to reiterate. We believe that consent and sexual activity takes place in a marriage relationships, but we recognize that that doesn't always happen. We want to make sure that we're very clear about what consent is and how that should be given so that there can be no misunderstandings. So consent must be communicated by word or action and must be mutually understandable, cannot result from threat or force or intimidation, and it cannot be given ever by minors, mentally disabled persons, those who are mentally or physically incapacitated, and we'll talk a little bit more about incapacitation as well. Consent to one form of activity does not imply to another form of activity. So I can consent to kissing, but not consenting to any other type of sexual activity later on. I can consent to having sexual intercourse on Thursday, but not consent on the next day. A person has to give consent along every step of the way. Consent is never implied and cannot be assumed, even in the context of a relationship. And just because you're in a relationship, that does not mean that you have permission for having sexual activity with your partner. Consent is voluntary, sober, enthusiastic, wanted, informed, mutual, honest, and verbal. And we recognize that that's a lot to ask. And that's one of the reasons why it's best to not engage in sexual activity until you're in a stable, long-term marriage covenant relationship with someone.
And just in case you're still wondering what consent is, we found this little video.
If you're still struggling with consent, just imagine instead of initiating sex, you're making them a cup of tea. You say, hey, would you like a cup of tea? And they go, I would love a cup of tea, thank you. Then you know they want a cup of tea. If you say, hey, would you like a cup of tea? And they're like, I'm not really sure. Then you could make them a cup of tea or not, but be aware they might not drink it. And if they don't drink it, then, and this is the important part, don't make them drink it. Just because you made it doesn't mean you are entitled to watch them drink it. And if they say no thank you, then don't make them tea at all. Just don't make them tea. Don't make them drink tea. Don't get annoyed at them for not wanting tea. They just don't want tea, okay? They might say, yes, please. That's kind of you. And then when the tea arrives, they actually don't want the tea at all. Sure, that's kind of annoying as you've gone to all the effort of making the tea, but they remain under no obligation to drink the tea. They did want tea, now they don't. Some people change their mind in the time that it takes to boil the kettle, brew the tea, and add the milk. And it's okay for people to change their mind. And you are still not entitled to watch them drink it. And if they're unconscious, don't make them tea. Unconscious people don't want tea. And they can't answer the question, do you want tea? Because they're unconscious. Okay, maybe they were conscious when you asked them if they wanted tea. And they said yes. But in the time it took you to boil the kettle, brew the tea, and add the milk, they are now unconscious. You should just put the tea down. Make sure the unconscious person is safe. And this is the important part again. Don't make them drink the tea. They said yes then, sure, but unconscious people don't want tea. If someone said yes to tea, started drinking it, and then passed out before they'd finished it, don't keep on pouring it down their throat. Take the tea away. Make sure they're safe, because unconscious people don't want tea. Trust me on this. If someone said yes to tea around your house last Saturday, that doesn't mean they want you to make them tea all the time. They don't want you to come around to their place unexpectedly and make them tea and force them to drink it, going, but you wanted tea last week. Or to wake up to find you pouring tea down their throat, going, but you wanted tea last night. But if you can understand how completely ludicrous it is to force people to have tea when they don't want tea, and you're able to understand when people don't want tea, then how hard is it to understand it when it comes to sex? Whether it's tea or sex, consent is everything. And on that note, I'm going to go make myself a cup of tea.
So again, we want to reemphasize that consent to any type of sexual intimacy is best preceded by thoughtful conversation about your sexual principles and your sexual boundaries. We know that it's difficult to raise this topic, especially in the context of someone you're just getting to know. But there are ways to do that, and here's one. Another is simply just to acknowledge that it's hard to get started talking about this, but that I'd like to begin talking about how we feel about sex and our physical boundaries. Can you do that with me? Even married couples find that communication is required to have a good, mutually enjoyable sex life. But we do find some students on this campus who enter into sexual relationships with virtually no communication at all.
And it's important to understand and to share with people that if you can't have a conversation with someone about sexual activity, you shouldn't engage in sexual activity with them. So we just want to just help them to think about it in a slightly different way.
We're going to just briefly touch incapacitation here. And you know, incapacitated persons, as you saw in the video, just lack the physical or mental ability to make informed, rational judgments about their behavior. They're just unable to understand the who, what, where, and when of what's going on. And this may be because they're asleep, they may be unconscious, or they may be in a blackout, which results in memory loss. Actually, blackouts are not well understood. It's not the same as being unconscious. Blackouts are those that happen when people are under the influence of alcohol or drugs, and they appear to be functional or coherent, but are actually unable to remember what has taken place. And for that reason, we advise, when we give this presentation to undergraduate students, that you always err on the side of caution. If one or the other or both are intoxicated, you should back away immediately from any sexual involvement. And that being drunk is never an excuse for sexual misconduct, nor does it diminish your responsibility.
Trace here for DNews with some drunk science. Now there's drunk and then there's blackout drunk. Those are the times when you're so bombed that you literally have no memory of anything that you did or said. A whole chunk of time is just lost. Count yourself lucky if this has never happened to you, but why does this even happen? First, let's talk about how memories are made. Scientists aren't exactly sure, but they think it has to do with the hippocampus. On a normal day, the synapses of your brain communicate with each other to build your experiences. It's a chemical process pulling in information from your senses, your experiences, and your feelings at the time, all folded into the cells of your gray matter. Your cells communicate with each other using a neurotransmitter chemical called glutamate. Glutamate helps bridge the synaptic gap between brain cells so memories can be stored and accessed. But alcohol is a toxin that affects that glutamate. See where I'm going here? According to a study in the journal Alcoholism Clinical and Experimental Research, functional MRI scans of drunk students found our brains, once intoxicated, increase blood flow to the parts that control attention and cognitive functioning, as well as the parts that create memory. As the blood becomes more and more saturated with alcohol, females will begin to black out, and then males. Blackouts start at blood alcohol levels of around 0.15. During blackout, or drug-induced brain dysfunction, as it's called medically, the hippocampus stops writing memories. Basically, our 20 to 30 seconds of short-term memory gets full, and it resets, and that's all we got. You didn't forget. You weren't even recording, dude. You could ask a blackout drunk person about a story from their childhood, but ask them what happened a few minutes ago, they'd have no idea. A blacked out person is akin to being a walking, talking, unconscious person.
And this is something we've actually seen a number of times on this campus as it relates to sexual misconduct. We have someone that is somewhat giving consent in some sort of way, but we have one person believing they have consent to a sexual activity, but the person is incapacitated due to drugs or alcohol, and they are not recording or making memories. However, it's important to remember that if someone's incapacitated, even if the individual says yes, it still can be considered sexual assault if the reasonable person, without being under the influence, would not consent to that sort of activity. It's a highly risky situation, which is why we again encourage our students that, especially where alcohol and drugs are involved, sexual activity and alcohol and drugs, it's a very bad intersection.
We'd like to encourage you now that you as a bystander can make a difference, whether it's with your peers here or with undergraduate students that you may be associating with. The strongest enabling factor actually in sexual violence is the idea that such behavior is kind of on the down low okay, that it's tolerated. If you think about our seminary student makeup here, more than four men are in this room for every woman. Okay, that's a lot of male bystanders. And again, that can be a lot of assent two male attitudes that may go unchecked. The bystander effect is that effect that says if a lot of people are standing by and no one intervenes in the situation, we're more likely not to intervene. Actually, we're just all more likely to stand there and watch with everyone else. But the good news about the bystander effect is that you can intervene. And that, in fact, people's beliefs about what other people think are stronger when it comes to the acceptability of sexual misconduct than their own personal beliefs. And so one person stepping forward into a situation and putting their stamp of disapproval on something that has been said or done can be a very, very powerful thing, and others may follow. And so we want to encourage you to speak up. We want to encourage you to step in, because if just one person does it, it can be the thing that breaks that bystander effect.
So what can you do to make a difference? And we feel, especially for those of you that are studying to be pastors, that there are specific precautions and boundaries that you can establish to make a difference in your personal life and those of your colleagues, as well as you work with your parishioners moving forward.
And here we're going to begin to take just not only a glance toward your life at Andrews University, but also your professional lives to come. It's important for you to take precautions and to set boundaries for yourselves as emerging professionals. First of all, you should meet with an accountability partner regularly and honestly. Do you have someone you can speak about anything to without the fear of recrimination or losing your job? Someone who can keep you honest.
Never be alone with a parishioner, counseling or Bible studies or home visits, especially in opposite sex situations. You want to make sure that you're never alone.
You should be leaving your office door open or the window in it uncovered when you meet with someone. And that desk should always be between you and your parishioner to keep things professional.
Avoid even casual physical contact. I know Dr. Yagel here talks about a church that some churches say that they're hugging churches. And as a people, we like to hug. But we want to be aware that some people misconstrue some types of physical contact. So set some boundaries and keep those hugs side hugs. Make sure that there's no inadvertent touching.
Counsel or study with members of the same sex only. If it's not possible to do that, you should be teaming up with a professional partner of the opposite sex to be with you in that situation. And if the person that you're counseling with or studying with objects to that, doesn't want that sort of a plan, then it's probably a good time to refer them on to someone else.
And never assume invincibility. Given the wrong circumstances, every pastor, every personal is vulnerable to temptation, sin, and the abuse of power.
And finally, self-awareness is really worth so much. Learn to heed the warning signs, and they are out there. And you need to tune into your own psyche and your own body on these. Do you look forward, for instance, to being with a particular parishioner or a member of your youth group more than others?
Do you actually fantasize or think more about someone than you think about someone else?
Or do you meet with a certain parishioner more often or more rarely than others, or in unusual places, or for longer periods of time? These are all warning signs that, if heeded, could let you know that you need to put steps into place immediately. Finally, just to wrap it up, we want to say that this is very difficult terrain. And what you can do to know the terrain of power and consent, for instance, is very important. You should remember that minors can never give consent. And because of the power relationship between you and a parishioner, parishioners can also not give consent. But there's more than consent involved here. Each one of us needs a moral and an ethical compass, one that's deeply rooted, first of all, in an awareness of our own emotional and sexual history and terrain, as well as a compass that is rooted and guided in God's ideals for human sexuality. And so we would like you to take this terrain very seriously. As you can see with our fact patterns, these aren't just fact patterns. These are complex stories and histories. And every time we get into a situation with a student, we realize that. And there were always red flags. There were always caution signs in the road that could have been heeded, and people didn't. So please, take time to be honest with yourself. Know thyself. If you need assistance, if you need help, we have resources here on campus at the Counseling and Testing Center.
And I've got a booklet here. I don't have enough for all of you, but for some of you, Understanding Sexual Misconduct Among Spiritual Leaders. We'll make sure that they're left here up front if you want to pick up one, and we'll actually have more here delivered within the coming days. And we want to just end by saying that you can make a difference. You can make a difference not only in your own life, but especially in the lives of your colleagues here in the seminary, the students at large here at Andrews University, and in the world at large as you work with your parishioners. What you believe and how you speak about those beliefs is important in making a difference as we deal with sexual misconduct on a college campus.
Thank you for allowing us to speak with you about difficult subject. We're always happy to dialogue with you after this session, and I think we're going to close with prayer. So.